I just congratulated Peter on making all his new friends. Good afternoon. It is nice to be here. I'm not sure it's the best time to ever have to speak to a group of priests. This time of the afternoon on this kind of a day is a very difficult time for you to be here. But today and tomorrow, what I hope to do is talk about the idea of formation, hopefully the idea of formation for priesthood as spoken about and inspired by the recent document following the Synod on Priestly Formation, Pastores Dabo Vobis. I believe all of you have a copy of it with your registration. It's worthwhile reading, and it's a good thing to reflect on in terms of the whole question. It's probably, at this point, the most complete piece of literature I've seen on the subject of priestly formation, and it's becoming a significant challenge to those of us involved in seminary work in terms of planning and implementing. So it will be a guiding document for a significant period of time. But I just did want to make one brief comment of hospitality. Hopefully, it's nice to have you here on the campus of Seton Hall. You probably know the Seminary of the Immaculate Conception is the School of Theology of the university. We're across campus. Some of the speakers are staying with us. We're too small to house the institute while you're here, but I'm not sure what sort of hospitality Peter was speaking about, but you're certainly most welcome to stop over and see the place while you're here. Let me begin by telling you a little story, or reading, I should say, a bit of a story that you may have heard last year. In fact, some of my ideas about this came last year when I read the story by Dr. Seuss that's been on the New York Times bestseller list for quite a bit of time now. The story is Oh, the Places You'll Go. Actually, Dr. Seuss wrote that. I forget his real name. But Dr. Seuss wrote that as a graduation address. And he was giving a commencement address, and rather than give the same kind of commencement address that people normally give, he wrote one of his typical stories. And some of it reads as follows. You have brains in your head, you have feet in your shoes, you can steer yourself any direction you choose. You're on your own, and you know what you know, and you are the guy who'll decide where to go. You'll look up and down streets, look them over with care. About some you will say, I don't choose to go there. You will come to a place where streets are not marked. Some windows are lighted, but mostly they're darked. Do you dare to stay out? Do you dare to go in? How much can you lose? How much can you win? I'm afraid that sometimes you'll play lonely games too, games you can't win because they'll play against you. But you will go on, though the weather be foul. On you will go, though your enemies prowl. Onward up many a frightening creek, though your arms may get sore and your sneakers may leak. Kid, you'll move mountains. Today is your day. Your mountain is waiting, so get on your way. Dr. Seuss, in his little story, instructs his listeners about preparation, the virtue of readiness, the virtue of being ready to go. Readiness draws on one's sense of the possible, as well as on one's awareness of limitation. To be ready is virtuous. It draws together other virtues. Humility, charity, temperance, perseverance, compassion, to name a few. Seminaries are places given to preparing people, given to developing the virtue of readiness, the readiness to undertake a mission, to embark on a journey. Readiness for the seminarian requires self-knowledge, as well as a deep and radical familiarity with Christ, with His church, and with the world. The seminary is a place, it's a time, it's also an environment wherein one readies himself for the journey of priesthood. As such, it cannot be seen as a place where one journeys to the priesthood. It cannot prepare for every eventuality, provide a directory of what to do in difficult situations, or leave one with a manual of priestly quick fixes. The seminary ideally is a place where people learn to be ready, about the need to be ready. The seminary is a place where each candidate is taught his own individual need to respond to the call to readiness, a readiness that gives one the ability to act in conformity with Christ, to whom the priest will be uniquely configured. The readiness that I speak about for seminaries involves a responsibility for self-formation, the awareness of one's stewardship over one's own priestly identity and ministry. This in itself is a great tension because the seminary is a place where hopefully people learn to be creative, to have initiative, to be responsible, but the seminary itself is also a structure. It's a place of authority, and it's a place where people must learn conformity and obedience. Self-formation is perhaps one of the best innovations in the document that I spoke about. All of the document that speaks about seminary formation ultimately leads to the conclusion that the only worthwhile formation is self-formation. And so the seminary ideally teaches people how to be ready at every point in their lives and their service as priests. The seminary is of service to the church by knowing and by teaching the example of lived priesthood. This experience, in concert with things like field education and pastoral development, is crucial. The seminary is also a place that has to prepare people by dealing with individual candidates and by knowing a lot about the culture from which they come. Personal and cultural identity are a major focus in formation, since these are indicators of a prior formation which must be confronted in the course of one's development. Seminarians today are not easy to describe. An average age may be established, but that does not tell us much. Family background may be traditional, or perhaps the candidate lived on his own for several years before entering. The family may or may not have been supportive of a priestly vocation. Parents may have been separated or divorced. The candidate may come ready to study theology and embark on the quest for a structured prayer life, or perhaps the seminarian has very little background in Catholic thought or exposure to Catholic life and tradition. Some candidates discern a priestly vocation because they work with priests, because they're involved in ministry of some sort. Some have little experience in church work and don't know anything about parish life or rectory living. The seminarian may arrive today from another country, be weak in the language of his new culture and communication, and have little to speak of materially. Another will be blessed with material success and a secure financial future. The trends about seminarians today, if there are any, are not obvious. The spectrum of external description does not allow for a simplistic or programmatic response to the demands of formation. Seminarians today are a very diverse group of people in temperament, in background, in age, in interest, and sometimes even in capability. No one program of formation can be established to meet every need or respond to each candidate. The psychological needs of each person in formation need to be taken seriously. The seminary today, in responding to this task, has certain universal expectations and values. It also recognizes the importance of dealing with the individual uniqueness of each candidate. The seminary establishes goals appropriate to the life and progress of each individual student. That, again, can cause tension within an institution. Cultural influences also play a key role in who the seminarian is and can be. They are themselves often in competition or conflict with what the church and the gospel are all about. The seminary must capture the attention of priesthood candidates in the face of many competing goals and competing cultural demands. In fact, it reflects the church in that work because the church itself shapes its mission in every age in response to culture and society. Both the strengths and the weaknesses of every time in society are the subject of the church's dialogue. It is no less critical for the seminary to educate priests who can enjoy and critique the world around them. There are characteristics that require particular attention in seminary formation today, characteristics that come from our culture and need to be confronted. They certainly do not exhaust what contemporary Western society is about, but they do indicate areas where seminary formation finds itself heavily committed today. The influence of these characteristics requires a serious concern on the part of the seminary as reflecting the concern for the church and its work in the world. The first of these characteristics that marks our culture today and certainly occupies a great deal of time in seminary formation is the factor of individualism. Individualism strikes me as a prime component of what many people in our society are made to feel like. Very often our culture prizes one's individual needs and preferences. A person's immediate fulfillment is often paramount. One's worth is often reduced to standards of preference or possession. The priest at one time was designated all things to all men, and at a later time all things to all men and women. But now the priest is called to be among men and women as leader and servant. Some of the old definitions do not fit. Some of the newer cultural influences carry with them a great sense of urgency in terms of who we form people to be today and the kind of priestly ministry they will exercise. Collaboration is as much a matter of one's spirituality as it is a style of ministry. Formation must confront individualism that can hamper one's ability to work with others and to acknowledge them and their talents. The priest today must be more of a team player than a star soloist. He can grow in his self-esteem only if he grows in concert with others, without whose company the capacity for loving service is diminished. A second factor that seminaries find a bit of a challenge today is the issue of the loss of accountability. If this were a theological discussion, we might spend some time talking about sin, but since it's a discussion about formation, I'll simply recognize that there is in our culture a loss or an erosion of the sense of accountability, and therefore of things like authority and obedience. To be held accountable is a very difficult thing. In a climate where past history can excuse one's present, where social pressure seems to eliminate responsibility for one's actions or omissions, authority and obedience lose their significance when individual freedom diminishes social responsibility and one's standards overlook any sense of justice or obligation. The priest today is one who must be formed in a spirituality accountable to the community in which he is a responsible member. The priest today must develop a spirituality that is accountable to the world in which he is a very significant participant. It calls for obedience set in the context of service to Christ and his body, the church, the institution. Legitimate authority always bears a communal character and is exercised for the sake of the church's life and its mission. Obedience must be the response of one's freedom willingly placed at the service of other people. Seminaries today are places that must recognize the demands of inculcating a sense of accountability and develop in people an awareness of authority, of the meaning of structure, of the role of collaboration in a society that must be within itself accountable. And so candidates today must grow in their ability to learn what good communication is about. They must be taught ways to respond to conflict. They must be taught ways to deal with anger and frustration and disillusionment with themselves, with one another, as well as with the institution. To surrender to authority and to hold oneself accountable is a very difficult thing today, and it's a very difficult thing for some seminarians to learn. De Lubac notes in The Splendor of the Church the dynamic of obedience, which I believe is instructive here. Even in the grimmest cases, in such cases most of all, in fact, He will find a certain harmony of what seems to be imposed from outside and what seems to be inspired from within. For the Spirit of God does not abandon him any more than the Spirit of God ever abandons the church as a whole. And what he does in the church as a whole is also what he does in each Christian soul. Formation for the priesthood today demands that one be steeped in accountability after the model of Christ-like obedience. Thirdly, our culture is characterized by a sense of rationalism. Rationalism, which can be the separation, for example, of religion and science, or certainly the separation of religion from other areas of life. Our culture frequently rejects the idea of the spiritual playing a significant part in human history and human decision-making. Religion can become extrinsic to the conclusions and the possibilities of technical progress and social endeavors. Ethics becomes inevitably compromised. The seminary today seeks to challenge the tendency to separate religion from other areas of life. It's not good to form priests who believe that their primary role is in the sanctuary, or that their exclusive role should be within the church itself. The candidate for the priesthood today must involve himself in the sanctuary as well as in the marketplace, in the church as well as in the world of science and social concern. The procreation of human life and the creation of human wealth both fall under the solicitude and the challenge of human reason and revealed truth. The church's very proclamation of the gospel encourages the pursuit of human wisdom. Only when the priest can be comfortable as a partner in dialogue, comfortable both in teaching and in learning, will he minister effectively to others in the service of truth. Formation must accept the task of developing candidates who are intellectually aware and capable of good and critical judgment. And finally, our society can be characterized by loss of a sense of permanence in its commitments. Marriage and family life today seem to resist the demands of commitment. Divorce, family instability, the cult of meaningless familiarity in human relationships all undermine traditional supports for permanence and fidelity. It's not always immediately clear why permanence and stability and perseverance in one's commitments is necessary. The responsibility of the seminary is to instill a sense of readiness with a strong component on the notion of perseverance. The possibility of permanent commitment must be communicated to seminarians very honestly, and it probably can only be done through the dynamic of personal witness. In this, the question of celibacy looms large in a climate so skeptical and preoccupied with individual needs. A healthy emotional life obviously is required of priests, a life sensitive to the capacity for good friendships and not afraid of genuine human warmth. Bridging the gap between those two understandings is a very daunting task. It is one that can only be undertaken by the seminary with a great degree of honesty and professionalism. The priest today finds a great deal of support in his life and ministry and in his faith from people, especially from the people he ministers to. Seminaries must inculcate a sense of respect for the dynamics of maturely relating to other people, for developing healthy relationships with them. The priest's readiness to minister to others can never be resting on insensitivity or any kind of fear of those around him. Nor should seminarians receive the suggestion that there are simplistic solutions to issues related to celibate love. The seminary must offer guidance, support, and hope about the charism of celibacy and about the possibility of priestly commitment from the very first days of priestly formation. These four factors are probably things that stand out to me in terms of what our society does to people before they come to the seminary. And so they are issues that seminary formation often finds itself dealing with. There are others, And there are good factors in society which seminarians bring. But I mention these so that the focus of formation can be on developing people who can be ready in the face of carrying on a critical and successful dialogue with the world throughout the course of their ministry. The seminary is charged with providing the environment wherein candidates for the priesthood learn to listen to the Holy Spirit and to live with a sense of readiness and eagerness to serve God and His people. This task is built primarily on the dynamic of self-formation, not always the primary goal of seminary formation. In the past, seminaries were often given more to the inculcation of a sense of duty rather than the inculcation of a sense of self-formation. The Church's current emphasis on the work of ongoing formation means that there has to be some kind of renovation in terms of what seminary formation should be focusing on. The document Pastores says the following: the future priest must grow in his awareness that the agent par excellence of his formation is the Holy Spirit, who by the gift of a new heart configures and conforms him to Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd. In this way, the candidate to the priesthood will affirm in the most radical way possible his freedom to welcome the molding power of that Spirit. This readiness of being attuned to the Holy Spirit, mediated through the Church and through one's ministry, becomes a critical virtue for priestly ministry. It makes the priest sensitive to the wonder of the priestly calling as a communal vocation. It is an office given to the Church for the sake of serving other people. Readiness to follow the Spirit's lead makes one's capacity for spiritual growth more expansive. To be formed after the heart of Christ can only give one a heart meant to love Him and the world more profoundly. The spiritual life of the seminarian is not a matter of individual holiness. It is rather a radical move to pursue the work of love in imitation of Christ, the great high priest and good shepherd of us all. The seminarian's commitment to discernment of his own vocation must become commitment to living out that vocation in service to other people. This development occurs only if one can grow in mature affection for the Church, wherein one's vocation is nourished, and where one's vocation finds its real meaning. The seminarian serves God and the Church by an energetic embrace of the world. The presence of God's kingdom needs to be proclaimed through sacrifice and service. If, as Lumen Gentium says, the Church is the initial budding forth of God's kingdom in the world, the seminarian must seek first to become the instrument and witness to that kingdom. What formation does for the seminarian is worthwhile to the extent that it responds to the eventual demands of the priesthood and manifests fidelity and personal commitment in the life of the one called to that vocation. As priests, we have a powerful influence on seminarians. We should be very much aware of the influence and example that we can provide for them. We also should be zealous in our willingness to pray for them. Our zeal in this and our encouragement of future vocations to the priesthood often become measures of our own self-understanding. Paul gave to Timothy words that we can also speak, but words which may be more valuable as reminders of where each one of us has come on our journeys. These are words of great hope and direction. Do not let people disregard you because you are young, but be an example to all believers in the way you speak and behave, and in your love, your faith, and your purity. You have in you a spiritual gift which was given to you when the prophets and the body of elders laid their hands on you. Do not let it lie unused. Think hard about all this and put it into practice, and everyone will be able to see how you are advancing. Take great care about what you do and about what you teach. Always do this, and in this way you will both save yourself and those who listen to you. Formation is never an exact science. It must be technical, but it also must be inspirational. It should teach us and remind us about being hopeful and about being ready to do what God asks of us yesterday and today and certainly tomorrow. And he might say to us in words more casual than the scriptures, but certainly with the same degree of dynamism, "Kid, you'll move mountains. Today is your day. Your mountain is waiting, so get on your way." Thank you. There's time for some questions. I know Monsignor Cusack has several, but I'll see him later.
Calistus Caetano from Belize. My question is, like in the early 60s and 70s, many of our young candidates to the priesthood were kind of left after they were ordained. What is being done now to assure that they spend longer time or serve the church?
What is being done to ensure that people don't leave? Dr. Seuss didn't tell me that. I don't know. I think the seminary today, by necessity, is a place of less certainty than it probably was in the 50s and somewhat before that. I would suspect that in the 1960s, the seminary itself as a structure went through a lot of change and a lot of instability, and a lot of the clarity and certainty that was behind what the seminary was about gave way to very fluid structures through the 70s and probably around the 1980s with the Vatican visitation of seminaries and all of that. Probably some of that fluidity was brought into some kind of more meaningful structure again. In fact, it seems to me that back in the 70s, a lot of seminaries were priding themselves on how unique each seminary was and how different seminaries were one from the other. It seems in this day and age there are differences among seminaries, but we're back to having seminaries to be very similar to one another again. That's probably good, although it can lead to certain things which we have to challenge ourselves on. What is being done in that kind of environment to be sure that there's not a massive leaving of people after ordination? Probably the seminary itself seeks today to make people more personally aware of themselves, to take advantage of psychology and counseling and certainly a good emphasis on spiritual direction. I think the seminary structure today is built on the fact that seminarians spend a lot of time in parishes and working outside of the seminary structure itself. We depend on evaluations of people other than seminary faculty to give us feedback, to make judgments on people. Seminaries today deal with a clientele of individuals who come already having gone through some of the uncertainty of life and the not having made a firm decision about what they will do with their whole lives. I think all of those things form a mix that the seminary takes advantage of in trying to rely on a person's self-assessment as much as on our assessment. In the seminary today, I'd say out of a class of, if we have 20 students in each of our 4 years, for example, I would say at the end of every year, one, two, maybe three students leave. And that's about it. And I think in the past few years, our experience has been that there will be some students who leave after ordination, but it's a very small number. Again, I think that's because there's probably the greatest amount of time spent in seminaries today And Monsignor Cusack can attest to this from sitting through the grueling meetings that we have to sit through. Probably the greatest amount of time that we spend is spent evaluating students. If we didn't have to evaluate students, we could do a million things in seminaries that we're not doing today. But you spend an awful lot of time dealing with and assessing each and every student as an individual. That struck me very much recently. I was down in the records room of our seminary, and I came across records of seminary evaluations when the seminary was a much bigger place. And the records of the seminary evaluations were really astounding. Whole classes were evaluated on one sheet of paper. The classes would have like 19 names, and under the 19 names, there'd be one sentence of evaluation written about them. All passed on will be suitable as priests. Maybe one or two names would be needs correction for this or the other reason. Does not seem to possess obedience or something like that. But the work of evaluation is maybe practically the most significant contributor to coming to know a candidate and trying to assess what an individual candidate will do in the future. I think evaluation and things like spiritual direction and getting a person serious and intensely involved in their own discernment are the critical factors. This past year, we spent from January until May evaluating students every Tuesday, and toward the end of the semester, we had to schedule extra meetings for the faculty. Because sometimes you can spend an hour or two at a meeting talking about one particular student. And that's 8 or 10 people trying to get to the bottom of how you can respond to a student's formational needs, etc. So I'd say the work of evaluation, bringing in everything else the seminary is about, probably is where our money is right now in terms of making good bets on people. Does that answer your question, Father? Okay.
Roderick Giller, Atchison, Kansas. Father, I just wonder if you could give me a profile on the age of candidates who come in, maybe their education level and experience, so that what kind of people should I be looking for out on a parish who might be candidates to come into seminary, and maybe from your talking with seminarians, what prompted them to make the decision to come into the seminary?
It's hard to do that because it's hard to draw a profile, but I think one of the things that you do hear over and over again is that people still come to seminaries because they've had good experiences with priests. And one of the best elements, I think, of seminary formation today, because it is one area that seminarians really get energized in, is the opportunity they have to be out of the seminary in parishes working with priests. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about the survey of priests ordained 5 to 9 years. One of the most significant elements for priests ordained 5 to 9 years as they look back at their priesthood was the impact of their first pastor and their first assignment. I think the same could hold true with seminarians. Seminarians tend to be people who had good experiences with priests. Many of them had some kind of involvement with the church along the way. Maybe in youth ministry or working in a nursing home or teaching in a school, but in some way they were drawn in to do work and people gave them the opportunity to do that. I think we also, as I'm thinking of seminarians in our seminary, families are prime contributors of seminarians. Many of our seminarians do come from families where the church is supported, where the church is important, where faith is talked about. People along the way who stand out in a school or in a family or in a parish or in some kind of ministry, those are people that if you can tap, you can sometimes invite them. You also have many people who show up at the doorstep of a seminary who are there for reasons they're not even clear on. Maybe some guys come and they've never been inside a rectory, or they never did work with a priest, or they don't know really what parish life is like. I've talked to guys ordained over the past couple of years, and a couple of them, and it's a minority, but a couple are even surprised after the seminary when they go to a parish I didn't know it was going to be like this. And they don't say that in a good way. Some of them have been discouraged by rectory living, or by the seminary is one form of life and rectory living is another. But I think those things that I mentioned are significant. One of the things it's hard for me to put categories on in terms of the diversity, our seminary here at Seton Hall, for example, out of the 80 or so students we had this past year in 5 years, pre-theology and 4 years of theology, one-third of our students in the seminary, most of that third being for the Archdiocese of Newark, were from a culture whose native language is not English. So seminary formation today also has that problem. We have Haitians. We had 3 Polish students ordained this year from Poland, Nigerian students, Filipinos. You have the added dynamic and the added burden of trying to communicate with people using the same words but not quite sure is the formational impact getting across. So there's a diversity from that element too. One-third of our students, in other words, are now in classes that teach English. That's a higher proportion. This university, the rate of that is about one-fourth of the student body, and at the seminary it's one-third. So there's an awful lot of formation that has to go on that level too. Our foreign students, international students, often tend to come from families who value the priesthood. That seems to be characteristic of the international student population in the seminary. But with the American students, it's a mix of a lot of different things. In the seminary, we take students really into their 50s. The average age is now around 30. Over the past few years, the average age has gone down. A few years ago, it was higher. With the increase in the size of our student body, the average age has come down. Most seminaries are indicating a decline in the age over the past couple of years. Whether that means a trend or not is too soon to tell. But there seems to be a certain number of young people willing to come to the seminary. This year we did ordain a couple of people who were 25 years old. Most of the ones we ordained were under 30 this year. But we also do have students in their 50s and stuff too.
Balderrama from Milwaukee. Most of us know about the primetime program last Friday. What are you doing? What's being done here to screen or do something about it?
I didn't see it. That was the program on pedophilia?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't see it, but I've heard people talk about it. What we've done is we've sought to develop with our vocations board to the extent that it seems possible for us to do that, because some of the professional information is not always easy in that area. There doesn't seem to be a lot of sureness in terms of the screening that can be done, but what we're trying to do is tighten up on the psychological tests at admission and to seek to do what we can to observe patterns of behavior throughout the seminary, realizing that some patterns of that sort of behavior will not be evident in our environment. But we just try to follow up on what's given to us in terms of background recommendations, a tightening up of the psychological information, to try and surface and project whatever information we can. It's a very difficult challenge for seminaries right now. There seems to not be a lot of resources for us to take advantage of to do some of the testing that could be desirable. Where the NCCB's office, I know, is looking for ways of better testing and tighter screening and all of that. In the cases that, and they'd be very, very few, I think only a couple of cases that I have any personal knowledge of in terms of knowing people involved, it seems to me that a person could slip through routine or average screening. It doesn't seem to be predictable people who sometimes get involved in some of those situations. So I think at this point we're doing the best we can with our testing and with tracking people through the system. Possibly Monsignor Cusack at some point might informally chat with you about that.
Mick Burke from Australia, Monsignor. I'd just like to share with you one of the concerns that we have in our own country. In fact, this whole area has been discussed ad nauseam because of a concern of priests at the diocesan level, that in recent years, even with all the screening, and I sort of thank God that I wasn't screened too much, otherwise I probably wouldn't have been accepted in the seminary, but in recent years, the seminary tends to be attracting two groups of people. On the one hand, those that are strongly influenced by movements such as Opus Dei or Neo-Catechumenate, and on the other hand, which is a very polarised position, those that are liberal to the point that virtually anything goes. Now, in our own diocese, these men have been ordained and have moved into parish life and have caused real problems. Mm-hmm. Now, that's in our country. I don't know whether that applies in America, but certainly it is a genuine concern among our priests. Virin Medio Stat seems to have shot right out the window.
Mm-hmm. It's caused problems at both ends of the spectrum? Okay. I don't know if anyone yet among the speakers has mentioned it. The Seminary School of Theology here at Seton Hall has an enrollment of, at this point, about 25 or 30 neo-catechumenate seminarians. The Archdiocese of Newark has a neo-catechumenate seminary here. It's geographically about 20 minutes away from here. The seminary was founded here about 2 years ago. Sure. I'll try to do that because I'm not even sure the neo-catechumenates can do it, but I'll try. The neo-catechumenate is, if I say it's a movement, they would correct me, and if I call it an order-like group, they would correct me too. The neo-catechumenate is a new way of people coming together to form a society or a group to evangelize and to spread the gospel and the work of the church in the world. Now, the nearest thing that I can describe it as, it's almost like, to me, what it's almost like a religious order insofar as people come together, form communities, work on evangelizing other people, and at this point, having developed over the past 25 years or so, at this point, this group of people is producing people who now are ready to be priests. So it's a lay movement that's come of age to the point where some of its members now want to be priests, and they're forming seminaries around the world to do that. The most recent seminary, I believe, for the neo-catechumenates is in Berlin. Now, the neo-catechumenate population is an international population, so the students we have are neo-catechumenate students from all over the world, from a variety of different countries and backgrounds. The neo-catechumenate does not have a lot of affinity with programs like the RCIA and things we'd be familiar with in terms of the use of the word catechumenate. It's basically a movement toward evangelization. Now, they have their own seminary here in the diocese because they have their own formation program, and so therefore it seems like a religious order. However, when a man is ordained in the neo-catechumenate system, he is ordained by the bishop of a diocese for service in that diocese. So 2 years from now, when our students in the school get to the point of ordination, they will be ordained by the Archbishop of Newark and be considered on the rolls as Newark priests. They will serve the bishop, promise obedience to him, and if he gives permission, they will work in their apostolate, perhaps here in the diocese, or Africa, or South America, or Australia, or wherever else that may be. The Archbishop normally would give that permission after 3 or 5 years of service. They could begin to ask about going elsewhere. But their primary point of service and contact would be as a priest of the diocese in which they're ordained. Now, at this point, the seminary here, we have had a lot of contact with the neo-catechumenates, but the diocese itself hasn't. There are several parishes in our diocese which have the neo-catechumenate presence in them. In fact, my weekend assignment now is a parish where the neo-catechumenate presence is very active. The neo-catechumenate presence in a parish basically means that they come to a parish and establish Bible study and evangelization programs, and even gather once a week, normally on Saturday evenings, for the celebration of the liturgy. What's interesting and perhaps complicates the whole matter is that the neocatechumenate celebration of the liturgy is a little bit different from what we're used to. There are some changes in the rite of Mass when the neocatechumenates gather to celebrate Eucharist. They do the sign of peace at a different time. They always engage in dialogue homilies. They distribute the Eucharist to the whole congregation simultaneously. The priest then receives communion. They do different things liturgically, so it's not easy to always move the neocatechumenate people into the mainstream of the parish, and that's where parishes could have concerns. That's the neocatechumenates. My experience is here that the neocatechumenate students I've dealt with are analogously similar to Opus Dei, but they're not similar in ideological content. That they seem to be more attuned to an active commitment to evangelization, to working with the poor, to actually becoming part of a parish and even fitting in with its structure. In our seminary, they're among our better students. They do very well. And those who are prepared with a college degree and all can come to the seminary. Normally, that's our expectation. I think in the past few years, we haven't been confronted with ourselves with people of a very extreme theological temperament. I think in the diocese, we've gone through periods where we do have some extremely conservative people and some extremely liberal people among our ranks in the clergy. I think the seminary at this point is aware of the danger of that happening. My personal reaction to the challenge of that is simply always to ask a question, since I can't predict, nor can the seminary, what will happen necessarily when a person gets out. One of my personal concerns is always, if a man demonstrates a severe case of ideological commitment in an undue or inappropriate manner, then there's probably a personal issue at stake. Now, by that, I don't mean to say that every extremely liberal or conservative person is problematic. But I do think that if seminarians are unduly given to one or the other end of that spectrum, it's been my experience that there could be formational or personal issues that need to be dealt with and ought to be dealt with before formation toward the priesthood can continue. I also think if people demonstrate that they belong on either end of that spectrum, it's the job of any seminary to be comfortable with that person being able to meet the demands of exercising the priesthood once they are ordained. If a person will be disruptive, if a person will be unable to work with others or collaborate or to be part of the diocese, then I think it might not be prudent to recommend ordination for a man. But again, by that I don't mean everybody's got to fit the same mold. But there is a commitment to the diocesan church that's required of everybody being ordained, and the bishop's job is to know that. If people are not going to be happy or are going to spend their whole lives resisting what a diocesan church is doing, then it might be more prudent for them and the church if they weren't ordained at that time for that particular church. But again, I think in the seminary, the way we deal with it, or our experience of it, would be that if that becomes problematic, we're normally dealing with, it could be an issue of anger or hostility, or it could be someone's fears of certain areas, and I think we'd be not doing our job very well if we didn't address that. Does that answer your question, Father? I'm sorry I took so long on the neocatechumenate thing.
Donald McGinnis, Maryknoll. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia has inaugurated a program of a spiritual year, and would you think this will be picked up by other diocesan seminaries?
I don't think so. Philadelphia did it this past year, and I think the program went fairly well. I think a lot of bishops are concerned about doing something that's good and that's very spiritual and even very intense in the course of seminary formation. I think there's a lot of questions about the model of segregating a year of quasi-novitiate type training. Now, anyone involved in that year will resist the word novitiate, but I just use it. It's a quasi-novitiate type experience. I think it's a good idea to do something that's intensely given to the development of spirituality. But I think more and more it's incumbent, especially on diocesan seminaries, to develop in people a sense of realism about what the spiritual life can be and about how they can live a spiritual life in the context of a lived experience. I think especially diocesan priests need to be trained in how do you manage a spiritual life with doorbells and telephones and people and disruptions and running to the hospital and going to meetings. And while there is a benefit to the spiritual year, I myself would always feel that the best spirituality you can teach is the spirituality that you have to live through. And I don't mean to say that it's okay to keep people busy 24 hours a day, and seminaries ought to be places where there's never a special preserve of time given for things of the Spirit. But I do think that the more a seminary mimics parish life, in the best sense of the word, then the better the seminary will be. I think the last thing we want in any area, theologically, pastorally, spiritually, the last thing we want in any area is for people to be ordained in this day and age and be surprised when they wake up their first morning in a rectory. I just don't think that's good. So I'm not a big fan of the spiritual year. The document Pastores Dabo Vobis talks about the need for seminaries to do something creative with spiritual formation. And I think we have to find ways of developing in our students a healthy ownership of their spiritual life. And I think we ought to teach that the spiritual life ought to be owned and it ought to be dynamic and deeply ingrained in the face of busyness and schedules and overcrowding and all of that before you start to work in the parish. That seems to be one of the shortcomings of our traditional seminary system, that you live in the seminary one way, but then parish life was always so different. It seems to me that seminaries themselves are being told to minimize the transition, the pains of transition from seminary life to parish life. One of the benefits of our seminary now being on a university campus is all the liabilities that it has in terms of some of the bureaucracy and some of the intrusion of time and schedule and some of the things that we have to deal with that we wouldn't have to if we weren't here. The good thing about it is the seminary is forced to cope with society, with ideas, with other demands outside of itself. And that's a good thing. It's sometimes, once a month the Archbishop meets with groups of priests here in the diocese, and I'm usually at the meetings and talking about our formation program and all. Some of the older priests are surprised sometimes when I mention the fact that it's hard for me sometimes to get the whole seminary together. Priests who went through the old seminary system can't imagine how that could happen. But I don't know where our seminarians are most of the time. I hope I know where they are. I think I know where they are. But we have several of our students come and go in terms of campus ministry here at Seton Hall. Many of them are plugged into parishes, and on a given night that's not their assigned field ed night, they might be at the parish doing CCD or involved in a meeting or something. We're developing a program this coming year where two Sundays a month, second and third theologians will be in parishes on Sunday morning. Part of the reason why we're moving to that is because seminarians are so unmoved by Sunday liturgy in the seminary. I've really tried to do something with our Sunday liturgy, but honestly, I just can't imagine how we can do anything that replicates what seminaries used to do on Sunday. Here on this campus, it's a dead place on Sunday mornings, and our students feel like they're being punished because they have to go to church in the seminary. So if parish formation on Sunday mornings is available, I think we ought to take advantage of it, and we will do that. But that's, to me, where spiritual formation should occur, rather than lumping it together in a single-year type experience. Okay. Bishop.
From the Caribbean, It's not without reason that the DD after my name signifies Doctor of Demonology. Because I want to be the devil's advocate.
Okay.
I stand before you as one who came through that kind of system.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been to a seminary, but I've had a spiritual formation program in a novitiate.
Uh-huh.
And from there I went on to Catholic University, living on my own and going through the entire system, taking courses with religious priests, lay people, working with lay people, and yet I have been able to survive. My survival and perseverance I like to attribute to a large extent to this formation program before, one. Secondly, in Jamaica, where I was rector, we found that quite a few of the young men would leave the seminary. We instituted a pre-seminary program, and that helped to stem the dropout rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, thank God, not one priest ordained in Jamaica has left. Now, we feel that there's some connection between mm-hmm. that spiritual formation and the academic
mm-hmm.
and sure. pastoral formation afterwards, because when you get a fellow coming out from his usual surrounding, he comes to the seminary, we demand of him academic excellence, we demand of him pastoral involvement,
mm-hmm.
and we demand of him some spiritual growth of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, let us give him a certain experience in that spiritual formation year before he gets into the other two dimensions of priestly formation.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that that has been very helpful. And just one other comment regarding the catechumenate. I have experienced too priests who have been saved, their vocation has been saved because of their experience of a catechumenate program. In Rome, I met a Mexican priest and another priest from another country who were about to leave their priesthood, but for the fact that they encountered a catechumenate community in a parish, and they claim that their priesthood is saved there. Just want to share those experiences mm-hmm. with you.
Thank you. Probably it's good to say that on the neo-catechumenate question, there's probably a lot we could talk about. Basically, here in the diocese, I should add that it's been a good experience for us, and the places that have had it have indicated a good experience. In terms of the question of the spiritual year, again, one of the things that's a factor, I think, in the discussion and probably should be talked about at some point, I won't do it now, the American bishops are on the verge of implementing a two-year pre-theology program, which means that before anyone studies theology, they'll be in school for 2 years developing an adequate background in philosophy and Catholic tradition and history and all of that. The only people who presumably would not be subject to the two-year program would be those coming out of a college seminary, which at this point appears to be fewer and fewer. So most people coming into our theologates will now be exposed to 2 years pre-theology. What that means is we'll probably be looking at a major seminary training period that could average 6 years for people again, as it once did, but now it'll average 6 years even for most of those people who already have a bachelor's degree. So one of the projects that's before seminaries now is how to utilize that 1 or 2 year pre-theology program and how to develop it in a way which doesn't duplicate or repeat what happens in theology training. Spirituality, pastoral exposure, introduction to the study of theology and philosophy, all those things are going to have to be brought together in the first 2 years now. That time frame can hopefully be used to develop creatively ways to handle spiritual formation. And one of the hopeful things about that two-year period is probably that places are now scrambling to find ways of using a preparatory time, because when students get to theology, there's often not enough time to do what you have to do. And at this point, most students are ordained to the diaconate after 3 years of theology. So you only have sometimes 3 years to say this student is ready for ordination. That's not a lot of time. The pre-theology program will be a big help.
Wes Lamb from Staten Island. We have heard quite extensively about the church's decision, and they've been carrying it out, of accepting Episcopal priests into the Roman Church who are married. This seems to be very well received by our lay people. How is this matter being considered, if at all, in the seminarians' training? Secondly, in many parts of the country, we now have lay people and religious men and women administering parishes as close as Baltimore, Maryland, and doing a beautiful job. We also have more and more women becoming more and more involved in our church. How are these gentlemen being prepared to realistically accept and work with this reality? I raise these questions because, coming from the Midwest, I balance the two, and I'm scared at what I sense the church here on the East Coast, where it is today, in comparison to where the rest of the church in this country is. And how are these issues and things being discussed with these gentlemen so that once they are ordained, they can go out and reasonably and realistically face what they're going to have to face?
I think one of the cautions I'd have to say, maybe just to protect my own flanks, is that the seminary probably can't do everything, but I think the seminary ought to be preparing a person to be able to enter into anything. In terms of the first question, the married priests, I think we probably don't do too much. We do have at least one of those fellows studying with us. He lives with his wife and children not too far from here. And informally, I guess many seminarians are aware of him and relate to him and know what he's about. And I think in the course of discussing celibacy and forming people for that, some discussion of that occurs. I don't think it's been a primary focus of much work in terms of the seminary. In terms of the style of the church and how men are being prepared, one thing I think that happens is that, and students themselves remind me of this, or us of this, when we talk to them, sometimes we talk to seminarians today as if they are coming from an experience of the church which didn't have women or lay people in serious positions, whereas a lot of our seminarians are coming to the seminary precisely because of the lay people in leadership positions and things in the church that they worked with. So seminarians often bring a pretty good sense of where lay people and women are. In fact, seminarians sometimes say, "Well, I don't know what issue you're talking about. We were living in that church. We came to the seminary last year. We were living in part of that." So sometimes that's our issue. But I do think there are seminarians who come who are not well schooled in dealing with lay people and understanding women and where they are in the church. I think one of the influences that hopefully builds some bridges and breaks some of the potential bad feeling down, if that's what it can be called, is the study of theology. We are a school of theology, and as such, we do welcome men and women, lay people, sisters, priests, into study with seminarians. So the study of theology is done by people who are involved in ministry already, as well as with seminarians. I think our field education program is designed to look at areas of collaboration. We have women who are supervisors for our students in field education. Students are exposed to a hospital program that's overseen and supervised by women. The seminary faculty at this point is primarily priests, full-time resident priests, but there are also a good number of women on the faculty teaching courses and involved with the seminary in one way or another. So I think it's probably some structural, some experiential, And it is an ongoing concern that we have. Seminaries, I think, are always looking for ways of saying, are we doing enough to make sure that people have the right idea about this? The good thing about ordaining 22 priests in the diocese this year is that there's a lot of good priests ordained. We might also send the signal that if you ordain enough priests, then the question of lay ministry is then settled. I said to the students several times this year, if we were ordaining 1 million priests, we still would not have done enough for the question of lay ministry. Lay ministry is a matter of baptism, not ordination quantity. And I think we have to always be on top of that. So I think we try to sneak it in and insert it in various aspects of the program. I shouldn't say sneak it in. We insert it in various elements of the program and try to make it the normal thing to do. But I am aware of the observations about the East Coast Church. I think East Coast seminaries have a certain reputation of either being too clerical or too institutional, or at least those words are said in conversations that I hear when I'm at meetings with other rectors and all. So it's something I think we have to be on our toes about.
John Picari from Boston. I've heard you say something twice that I think is really good, that seminary cannot do it all. And I think one of the things that struck me as a newly ordained priest was that I was trained. Every moment of my life was watched and reflected upon for 8 hours on an individual and commented on and voted on and so on and so forth. Hands were imposed. I was sent out to a parish and I never heard from them again. And I've been through 5 pastors in 4 years.
Does that say more about you or them?
I don't know. I killed 2 of them. But I guess my question is, you know, when you say self-formation, I think that's another good point. What are you doing post-ordination? And I think that the Archdiocese of Boston it has kind of responded to that in a very light sense. And I know that in my day they were asking us questions about, you know, putting on this extra year and so on and so forth. And my class said, you can't teach us everything. There's nothing like getting that first call. I'll never forget my first night call. I mean, I was a deacon in this parish for a year, but I didn't get awakened at 2 o'clock in the morning. Everyone told me what it was going to be like. But there was no one there to help me. I mean, even the priest that I was with, I mean, it's just like, you know, you've been ordained for 35 years, you know, and what's going on in that end of formation?
I guess every diocese has a little bit of a different story to tell on that. I guess I know NORC itself has tried over the past few years, at least let me just address it in terms of newly ordained priests. NORC over the past few years has tried to develop a program of mentoring where guys would get ordained and then meet periodically with a mentor and all of that. A couple of times I know they've tried that and they've assigned mentors and people get together for lunch once or twice and then it just seems to die. So in terms of an immediate structured kind of program for fostering some kind of ongoing formation, I don't think we've solved that very difficult question. I do think that what the diocese tries to do is by way of continuing education, offer educational programs, workshops, study days, things like that, programmatic things that somebody can plug into. But again, the issue is going to be, does somebody have the motivation and the wherewithal and the freedom even to do that? I think as I read the new document that I've referred to already, the last fourth of that document is all on ongoing formation. It seems to me that it's the first time we've had such a complete and energetic and forceful statement about continuing education. I hear a lot from our priests about what we ought to be doing in seminaries to get people ready for ordination, but I'm always fearful we've had 400 years to deal with this, or 300, current seminary system. The one lesson we should learn is that there's a lot more time to work with people after ordination than before, and we should be as serious in time and money and personnel with continuing education as we are with pre-ordination formation. So I guess we're doing what's normally expected of us by way of continuing ed, but my own personal view would be that seminary formation could be much better harnessed and directed if it were more intensely followed up and more precisely followed up in certain areas. Some places are doing great things. But I think we have to, we deal with seminarians from a lot of different dioceses too, 12 or 13 here at Seton Hall. One of our challenges to deal with people going back to Manchester, New Hampshire, and Wilmington, Delaware, and Scranton, Pennsylvania, every diocese, even in this relatively local area, is so different. So I guess I'd say we'd probably have to do more. And seminaries would be very happy about looking further into that. I don't know if Monsignor has a... Thanks very much for listening. I appreciate that.